He looked up. The walls cantered in from each side, so that at places they almost met directly over his head. There was only a narrow strip of blue sky showing, and the depths were gloomy and dank. Over the ages the river had scoured the rock as it cut its way through. "Damned lucky, this is the dry season. What is it like down here in the rainy season?" he wondered. He looked up at the high water mark etched on the rock 15 or 20 feet above his head. Shuddering at the image, he looked down again, concentrating on the river ahead. He had his breath back by now, and he checked his body for any damage. With relief, he decided that apart from some bruising and what felt like a sprained knee, he was unhurt. All his limbs were responding, and when he swam a few strokes to one side to avoid another spur of rock, even the sore knee worked well enough to get him out of trouble. Gradually, he became aware of a new sound in the canyon. It was a dull roar, growing stronger as he sped onwards. The walls of the chasm converged upon each other. The gut of rock narrowed, and the flood seemed to accelerate as it was squeezed in and confined. The sound of water built up rapidly into a thunder that reverberated in the canyon. Nicholas rolled over and swam with all his strength across the current until he reached the nearest rock wall. He tried to find a handhold, a place where he could anchor himself, but the rock was polished smooth by the river. It slipped past under his desperately grasping hands, and the river bellowed in his head. He saw the surface around him flatten out and smooth like solid glass. Like a horse laying back its ears as it gathers itself for a jump, the river had sensed what lay ahead. Nicholas pushed himself away from the rock wall to try and give himself room in which to manoeuvre, and pointed his feet once more downriver. Abruptly the air opened under him, and he was launched out into space. All around him, white spuming water filled the air, and he was swirled off balance and tossed like a leaf in the torrent. The drop seemed to last forever, and his stomach swooped against his ribs. Then, once more, he struck with all his weight, and was driven far below the surface. He fought his way up, and abruptly burst out through the surface, with his breathing whistling up his throat. Through streaming eyes he saw that he was caught up in the bowl of swirling water below the falls. The waters revolved and eddied, turning in a stately minuet upon themselves. As he turned, he saw first the high sheet of white water of the falls down which he had tumbled, and then, still turning, the narrow exit from the basin through which the river resumed its mad career downstream. But for the moment he was safe and quiet here in the back eddy below the falls. The current pushed him against the side of the basin, close in beneath the chute of the falls. He reached out and found a handhold on a clump of mossy fern growing out of a crack in the wall. Here at last he had a chance to rest and consider his position. It did not take him long, however, to realise that his only way out of the chasm was to follow the course of the river and to take his chances with whatever lay downstream. He could expect rapids, if not another set of falls like this one that thundered away close beside him. If only there was some way up the wall! He looked up, but his spirits quailed as he considered the overhang that formed a cathedral roof high above him. While he still stared upwards, something caught his eye, something too regular and regimented to be natural. There was a double row of dark marks running vertically up the wall of rock, beginning at the surface of the water and climbing up the wall to the rim, almost 200 feet overhead. He relinquished his hold on the clump of fern and dog-paddled slowly down to where these marks reached the water. As he reached them, he realised that they were niches, cut about 4 inches square into the wall. The two rows were twice the spread of his arms apart, and the niche in one row lined up in the horizontal plane exactly with its neighbour in the second row. Thrusting his hand into the nearest opening, he found that it was deep enough to accommodate his arm to the elbow. This opening, being below the flood level of the waters, was smoothed and worn, but when he looked to those higher up the wall, above the water mark, he saw that they had retained their shape much more clearly. The edges were sharp and square. "My word! How old are they to have been worn like that?" he marvelled. "And how the hell did anyone get down here to cut them?" He hung on to the niche nearest him and studied the pattern in the cliff face. Why would anybody go to all that amount of trouble? He could think of no reason nor purpose. Who did this work? What would they want down here? It was an intriguing mystery. Then, suddenly, something else caught his eye. It was a circular indentation in the rock, precisely between the two rows of niches, and high above the high water mark. From so far below, it looked to be perfectly round, another shape that was not natural. He paddled further round, trying to reach a position from which he would have a clearer view of it. It seemed to be some sort of rock engraving, a plaque that reminded him strongly of those marks in the black boulders that flanked the Nile below the first cataract at Aswan, placed there in antiquity to measure the flood levels of the river waters. But the light was too poor, and the angle too acute for him to be certain that it was man-made, let alone to recognise or read any script or lettering that might have been incorporated in the design. Hoping to devise some way of climbing closer, he tried to use the stone niches as aids. With a great deal of effort, using them as foot and handholds, he managed to lift himself out of the water. But the distances between holds were too great, and he fell back with a splash, swallowing more water. "Take it easy, my lad. You still have to swim out of here. No profit in exhausting yourself. You will just have to come back another day to get a closer look at whatever it is up there." Only then did he realise how close he was to total exhaustion. This water coming down from the Choke Mountains was still cold with the memories of the high snows. He was shivering until his teeth chattered. "Not far from hypothermia. I have to get out of here now while you still have the strength." Reluctantly, he pushed himself away from the wall of rock and paddled downwards towards the narrow opening through which the Dundera River resumed the headlong rush to join her mother Nile. He felt the current pick him up and bear him forward, and he stopped swimming and let it take him. "The devil's roller coaster," he told himself. "Down and down she goes, and where she stops nobody knows." The first sets of rapids battered him. They seemed endless. But at last he was spewed out into the run of slower water below them. He floated on his back, taking full advantage of this respite, and looking upwards. There was very little light showing above him, for the rock almost met overhead. The air was dank and dark and stank of bats. However, there was little time to examine his surroundings, for once again the river began to roar ahead of him. He braced himself mentally for the assault of turbulent waters and went cascading down the next steep slide. After a while he lost track of how far he'd been carried and how many cataracts he had survived. It was a constant battle against the cold and the pain of sodden lungs and strained muscle and overtaxed sinew. The river mauled him. Suddenly the light changed. After the gloom at the bottom of the high cliffs, it was as though a searchlight had been shone directly into his eyes, and he felt the force and ferocity of the river abating. He squinted up into bright sunlight, and then looked back and saw that he had passed out below the archway of Pink Rock into that familiar part of the river which he had explored with Royan. Coming up ahead of him was the rope suspension bridge, and he had just enough strength remaining to paddle feebly towards the small beach of white sand below it. One of the hairy, tattered ropes dangled to the surface of the water, and he managed to catch hold of it as he drifted past and swing himself in towards the beach. He tried to crawl fully ashore, but he collapsed, with his face in the sand, and vomited out the water he had swallowed. It felt so good just to be able to lie without effort and rest. His lower body still hung into the river, but he had neither the strength nor the inclination to drag himself fully ashore. "I am alive," he marvelled, and fell into a state halfway between sleep and unconsciousness. He never knew how long he had been lying like that, but when he felt a hand shaking his shoulder and a voice calling softly to him, he was annoyed that his arrest had been disturbed.
"Effendi, wake up! They seek you! The beautiful Waizero seeks you!"
With a huge effort, Nicholas roused himself and sat up slowly. Tamri knelt over him, grinning and wagging his head.
"Please, Effendi, come with me. The Waizero is searching the river bank on the far side. She is weeping and calling your name.
Tamri told him this. He was the only person Nicholas had ever met who contrived to look worried and to grin at the same time. Nicholas looked beyond him and saw that it must be late afternoon, for the sun sat fat and red on the lip of the escarpment. While still sitting in the sand, Nicholas checked his body, making an inventory of his injuries. He ached in every muscle, and his legs and arms were scraped and bruised, but he could detect no broken bones, and although there was a tender lump on the side of his head, where he had glanced off a rock, his mind was clear.
"Help me up," he ordered Tamri.
The boy put his shoulder under Nicholas's armpit, where the rope had burnt him, and hoisted him to his feet. The two of them struggled up to the bank and onto the path, and then hobbled slowly across the swinging bridge. He had hardly reached the other bank when there was a joyous shout from close at hand.
"Nicky! Oh, dear God, you're safe!"
Royan ran down the path and threw her arms around him.
"I have been frantic. I thought that..."
She broke off and held him at arm's length to look at him.
"Are you all right? I was expecting to find your broken body."
"Oh, you know me." He grinned at her and tried not to limp. 10 feet tall and bulletproof. "You don't get rid of me that easily. I only did it just to get a hug from you." She released him hurriedly.
"Don't read anything into that. I am kind to all beaten puppies and other dumb animals."
But her smile belied the words.
"Nevertheless, it's good to have you back in one piece, Nicky."
"Where is Boris?" he asked.
"He and the trackers are searching the banks lower down the river. I think he is looking forward to finding your corpse."
"What has he done with my dik-dik?"
"There is certainly nothing too much the matter with you if you can worry about that. The skinners have taken it down to the camp."
"Oh, damn it to hell! I must supervise the skinning and preparation of the trophy myself. They'll ruin it." He put his arm around Tamri's shoulder.
"Come on, my lad. Let's see if I can break into a trot."
Nicholas knew that in this heat the carcass of the little antelope would decompose swiftly, and the hair would slough from the hide if it were not treated. It was imperative to skin it out immediately. Already it had been left too long, and the preparation of a hide for a full body mount was a skilled and painstaking procedure. It was already dark as they limped into the camp. Nicholas shouted for the skinners in Arabic.
"Ya, Kif! Ya, Salim!"
And when they came running from their living huts, he asked anxiously,
"Have you begun?"
"No, not yet, Effendi. We are having our dinner first." "For once, gluttony is a virtue. Do not touch the creature until I come. While you are waiting for me, fetch one of the gas lights." He limped to his own hut as fast as his aches would allow. There he stripped and anointed all his visible scrapes and abrasions with mercurochrome, flung on fresh dry clothes, rummaged in his bag until he found the canvas roll which contained his knives, and hurried down to the skinning hut. By the brilliant white glare of the butane gas lantern, he had only just completed the initial skin incisions down the inside of the dik-dik's legs and belly, when Boris pushed open the door of the hut.
"Did you have a good swim, English?"
"Bracing, thank you," Nicholas smiled. "I don't expect you want to eat your words about my striped dik-dik, do you?" he asked mildly. "No such bloody animal, I think you said?"
"It is like a rat. A true hunter would not bother himself with such rubbish," Boris replied haughtily. "Now that you have your rat, perhaps we can go back to Addis, English?"
"I paid you for 3 weeks. It is my safari. We go when I say so," Nicholas told him. Boris grunted and backed out of the hut. Nicholas worked swiftly. His knives were of a special design to facilitate the fine work, and he stropped them at regular intervals on a ceramic sharpening rod until he could shave the hairs from his forearm with just the slightest touch. The legs had to be skinned out with the tiny hooves still attached. Before he had completed this part of the work, another figure stooped into the hut. He was dressed in a priest's shama and headcloth, and until he spoke, Nicholas did not recognize Mek Nimur.
"I hear that you have been looking for trouble again, Nicholas. I came to make sure that you were still alive. There was a rumour at the monastery that you had drowned yourself, though I knew it was not possible. You will not die so easily."
"I hope you are right, Mek," Nicholas laughed at him.
Max squatted opposite him.